The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Thank you for the broadcast. Thank you for welcome back to the Frank Sontag Show. Wilbert's talking in my ears about a broadcast, and there's some exciting things going on in terms of the state. A friend of the program, a man we love, is about to make an announcement, and I guess he'll be on Hannity tomorrow and Newsmax tonight, and that's all that we're at liberty to say. We need to be on our best behavior. I have some things I want to share. I went to the movies over the weekend. I want to talk a little bit about that. We've got some news stories. But Deborah is on the phone and has a, at least on the prompt, something we've not talked about, but it's really caught my eye. Deborah in Compton, you're on the Frank Sontag Show. Deborah, are you there?
Oh, yes, I'm here.
Hi.
I was thinking about, I caught the tail end of some of your conversation. And I'm thinking about these churches and how they're not full like they used to be. So I'm hoping that they'll get another message out of all of that and build some housing maybe on some of these properties that's got their paid off land and all this good stuff. Mm-hmm. If it ain't full, you need to fill it by maybe building some low-income housing to help out a few people. You know what I mean? Because the church is within you. And I did more praying and more having church in my living room than I've done, you know, in a church in the last year, and enjoyed every bit of it. I mean, developing a great relationship with my Lord and Savior. So I do go back now to fellowship, have communion, you know, fellowship with the saints. That's a part of what we're supposed to do. But I'm just wondering about where they're going with this church stuff. And as far as COVID, just for today, I'm not trying to take the vaccine because I'm just not there yet. I don't know what's stopping me. I ask God to just make it plain for me. I work in street outreach. Eventually, I may have to take it, so I'm praying now that I have no side effects. That's pretty much all I have to say.
Deborah, I thank you for calling. I could sit and listen to you for hours. The prompt on the screen is a question. What do you think of these churches sitting empty? I don't even want to share my thoughts. I just want to hear what you said. And the idea of taking the vaccine, maybe I'll jump into that. I think that may be a theme we can kind of weave into this. And then I'll share my comments about the movies and some things I saw over the weekend for later in this hour. So let's spend a moment on the idea of what we're seeing now. In fact, let me reach back. I've got like seven stories. I'll just read you the headlines, because they all have different parts of an opportunity for you to decide for yourself. Here's a breaking news story from the New York Times, a source that I don't hold that much in regard. The FDA is now planning to warn that the Johnson & Johnson coronavirus vaccine can increase the risk of a rare nerve condition in those to take the shot. Okay, that's mainstream news, the J&J shot. And see what you did, Deborah? I wasn't prepared, but I want to jump on what you said. Hang on. Oh, goodness, how many stories do I have here? All right, I need an assistant. I broke my finger over the weekend, and it's hard to grab stuff. All right, here we go. In no specific order, nurse blows the whistle on the medical industry, quote, they're not offering informed consent. You may know about Dr. Simone Gold. She has been on the program, America's Frontline Doctors. She said that COVID-19 is nothing to fear and that there are treatments already and have been available from the beginning. At the start of the pandemic, she was fired after speaking out in support of hydroxychloroquine. There's a story on the Epoch Times all about the intricacies of therapeutics and treatments that have been given to hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people, actually thousands of people. And her position is that, as we've talked more and more about in recent times, you're not going to hear this in the mainstream media. Why? You can draw your own conclusions. Here's another story. People who recover from COVID-19 are at very low risk of reinfection, according to the study based in San Dimas from a clinical laboratory, from a research facility. I believe it's called Curative. In other words, if you've been infected with COVID, you've got an immune system, you've got antibodies, you've got T cell. And the idea of you got to take the vaccine anyway. I don't know how that scientifically sound. Here's another story. Europe's drug regulator has found a possible link between rare heart inflammation and COVID-19 vaccines from Pfizer and Moderna, advising people with a history of a rare blood disorder to avoid getting the J&J shot. Here's a story from the California Globe headline. California public health officials silent on CDC vaccine injury report of 438,440 quote-unquote adverse effect events. I'll read a little of this. As written by Katie Grimes, in a strange announcement last Friday, the California Department of Public Health said that school children will have to continue to wear mandatory face masks in class despite new CDC guidelines saying that masks are no longer necessary in schools. California Health and Human Services Agency Secretary Dr. Mark Galli said, quote, "We will align with the CDC by implementing multiple layers of mitigation strategies, including continued mask wearing and robust testing capacity," end quote. And then Grimes talks about the obvious contradictions in statements made recently. She also cites Friday the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System, said there are 438,440 vaccine injury reports through July 7 of this year, as well as the myocarditis reports for ages under 20. That's heart inflammation. These reports say there have been 9,048 deaths, 26,818 hospitalizations, 56,970 urgent care visits, 3,324 heart attacks, 985 miscarriages, 19,105 allergic reactions, as well as many other adverse health events. Do your patriotic duty. Take the jab. Representative Chip Roy from Texas, who is an avid vaccine supporter, has now told the president in an interview over the reported door-to-door push to get vaccinated. Roy said, quote, "My dad had polio, and I grew up watching him live a life ravaged by that disease. I'm very pro-vaccine. It was a great blessing that a vaccine ended polio and that he was thrilled that the disease no longer impacted people." Roy went on to say, "Likewise, I'm delighted there are millions of people who are able to avail themselves of a coronavirus vaccine that they believe in their calculation is good for them and their well-being. That's great. But I'm just sick and tired of the left in this government dictating to me, frankly, anything at all, and they need to back off." Chip Roy said, "That's my message to the White House." There's a lot more, but I'll leave it at that. Many of you have shared the emails to me and sent emails about this idea of posting no trespassing signs on your door or no solicitation, like legally, if somebody comes knocking on your door, they can be charged with harassing if you have these signs up. Look, I'm not a lawyer, but my first thought is, if you think these people care about laws or somehow, you know, that's going to protect you, I'm not so sure I'm in that same mindset. And what about all the pressure, the hyper-aggressive pressure campaign to take this shot or take these shots? There's three different kinds, Moderna, Pfizer, J&J. Alex Berenson is one that I hold an interest in. I've read some of his printings and writings, and the man is very much a researcher. He was recently on Tucker Carlson.
The vast majority of people over 65 have taken the vaccine,
right,
which makes sense. The risk benefit for them to take the vaccine is better. It's more in their favor. So if you look at actual working age adults, it's only about 50% have taken the vaccine.
Okay.
And that means that's the idea that these guys were depending on corporate pressure. They didn't want to have a federal mandate. They thought that they could convince companies to, you know, airlines were not going to carry people, or they were going to make their flight attendants take the vaccine. Well, in a labor market that's tight, if half the adults of working age have not taken the vaccine, companies will back down. And you're sort of seeing that a little bit around the edges, which means they don't have the leverage they want. But I'm sort of a small mind thinker. You're a big mind thinker. You were thinking philosophically. I just think this is crazy in that the risk-benefit ratio of the vaccines appears to be getting worse almost by the week right now. We're seeing vaccine failure on a large scale in Israel and the UK and Scotland. We are seeing there's all this myocarditis here and everywhere else the mRNA vaccines are given. Why push this? And as you said, it looks like the pandemic is winding down in general. Although, again, in the UK, actually, cases are way up as the vaccines apparently begin to fail. And so why push it now? I think that's a really, really good question. And whether it's pure vindictiveness or whether it's something else, I don't know. I mean, I'm always reminded of the Santa Anna quote that the fanatic is the person who redoubles his effort when he's lost his aim. And it does seem right, like these people have just lost their aim and are just pushing harder and harder. But I will tell you this. They're talking about booster shots for people. They're talking about a third dose, you know, possibly more doses. I spoke to somebody today, and this is on my Substack, which people can go read if they want, which is nice because it's totally exempt from Twitter or Amazon. It's my own direct connection to readers. I interviewed somebody today who said, I've signed up for the trial. I got two doses. I signed up for the booster trial. I got a third dose. My third dose was much worse than the first two. I dropped out of the trial when they asked me if I wanted a fourth dose. And so if this is somebody who's pro-vaccine, signed up for the trial, and didn't want a third dose, I can't imagine what hesitancy is going to look like nationally when they try to push that.
Alex Berenson on Tucker Carlson. I'm not here to say yay or nay or what you are or are not to do. I'm just here to give you information. And I just powered through five or six stories that say, well, there may be cause for a bit of concern versus just blindly take a shot by which these are experimental drugs. They've not been approved by the FDA, contrary to what you may think. And like listener Deborah said, she's praying about it. She's not prompted right now to do it. God make it clear. And I think the idea of forcing, or this idea of an aggressive pressure campaign, what's really going on here? Now let me shift a little bit and talk about our young adults. And an area not often highlighted when it comes to, say, the last year plus of this pandemic. When we hear and see so much about fear and tragedy and this push in the narrative that somehow there's only one way to respond to this, and that is trust the government and do what they tell you to do. Some of us have been yelling from the mediums that we have about deaths of despair. What about young people? What about the elderly being locked up in homes where you can't even see your parents, just over a virus that literally 99% of the people that get it will survive? John Stone Street is the president of the Chuck Colson Center for Christian Worldview. He's written this commentary I want to share with you. It's called The Pandemic of despair. Young adult deaths highlight the need for hope. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, nearly 19% more Americans died in 2020 than 2019. Adjusted for population age, that's the largest one-year increase in mortality since the Spanish flu outbreak of 1918. The CDC attributes approximately 375,000 American deaths in 2020 to COVID, but making that the stat, the headline of this story would be bearing the lead. Unlike the Spanish flu, the COVID pandemic left young adults largely unscathed. Only about 3.5% of the recent pandemic's victims were in the 25 to 34 age bracket, yet deaths in this age group are still on the rise. In fact, working age adults are the only group whose age-adjusted mortality over the last few decades hasn't improved. Justin Fox reports that while the rest of the population has experienced increased health and life expectancies, younger adults, who are historically among the healthiest citizens, are dying at the same rate they did in 1953, a time when medicine and health care were not nearly as advanced as they are today. Back in March, the National Academy of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine issued a lengthy report which attempted to explain this data. The culprits identified for, quote, the high and rising mortality among working-age adults were external causes like drugs, alcohol, and suicide. Likewise, the CDC has identified a surge in drug overdoses as the main problem, especially the popularity of fentanyl and similar highly potent synthetic opioids. In 2015, economist Ann Case and Angus Denton gave this collective of killers a name, Deaths of Despair, end quote. Deaths of despair have been on the rise for years and are disproportionately concentrated among white, rural Americans without college degrees. More immediately, these have served as pre-existing conditions of COVID or, more accurately, comorbidities. Though numbers are still trickling in, rates of deaths of despair worsened sharply in 2020, when lockdowns and social distancing were at their peak, this according to the CDC. I'm reading a commentary by John Stone Street entitled The Pandemic of Despair. One lesson here is that because human beings are more than bodies, that public health is more than controlling infectious diseases. Hope is as essential for our well-being as health care. If we hope to prevent young adults from dying too soon, we'll first have to help them answer the question, what is there to live for? In a modern world filled with infinite choice and distraction, yet void of meaning, the answer to that question just is not clear for many, particularly young adults. They've lost hope. And Stone Street says, I'm not referring to a feeling. To borrow from Thomas Aquinas, an increasingly secular culture has removed any real conviction that it's even possible to, quote, share in the goodness of God, end quote. Too many of our public policies not only disregard the fullness of who we are as a human being, they fail to take into account that our culture is so thin on hope. For example, the impacts of lockdowns, social distancing, and extended isolation cannot be measured in mere economic terms. So too, any evaluation of the drugs that are approved and made widely available should, at the very least, take into account the rise in overdose deaths. We can no longer avoid uncomfortable questions about human value and pharmaceutical profits. Most importantly, the rates of deaths from despair should lead us to rethink what hope is and where it comes from. Stone Street writes, I cannot imagine anyone who would actually say that stuff is more important than people, or that our phones mean more than our children, or that we're better off alone and autonomous than with others and mutually responsible. or that mindlessly consuming entertainment designed only to provoke or distract is the true definition of the good life. Without argument, however, and through the persistent, perpetual, increase of our souls, many people have become convinced of this. The evidence is found not only in what we say, but in the hopeless ways we live. The real culprit here is a worldview described by the prophet Isaiah centuries ago, one which urges us to spend money on that which is not bread and to work for what cannot satisfy. Today we are urged to spend our resources and seek fulfillment in stuff, sex, state, and self. The countless Americans turning to aesthetics or anesthetics to numb their disappointment is proof that these things cannot satisfy. Lastly, who else can address this culture-wide pandemic of despair but the church? Who else, if not us fellow beggars, who have found the bread of life? In a society literally dying of despair, to, quote, always be ready to give an answer for the hope that you have to anyone who asks is not a mere suggestion. It's a calling. It's a matter of life or death. John Stone Street writes at breakpoint.org. You can find this commentary at the Christian Post. Pandemic of Despair, John Stone Street. 888-528-2557. More of the Frank Sontag Show next. Welcome back to the Frank Sontag Show. The numbers to call into this radio program are the same each and every day. 888-528-2557, or easier to remember, 888-52 and then talks, TALKS. One of the larger news stories that I've seen in recent time and pretty exciting is what's going on in Cuba. Now, I was reading a story where Twitter is trying to twist this in the way that they kind of manipulate perception. They're saying this is about COVID, when it seems like the overwhelming amount of information and people with boots on the ground said this is really not about COVID. This is about socialism and how people have had enough. All around Cuba over the weekend, thousands have taken to the streets to protest the dictatorship regime under Miguel Díaz-Canel and the many miseries that come from it. This is what happens when you live under such oppression. Food shortages, medicine. And again, you read Twitter and it's all about they're just angry because of COVID. It's just a lie. Not surprising, though. Some say this ignores the real reason why socialism is the disaster that it is. Francis Robles, who's a writer for the New York Times, wrote that the protests are, quote, a remarkable eruption of discontent not seen in nearly 30 years. Robles also tweeted that she had never, ever seen anything like the protest. She says, I've been covering Cuba since the 1994 rafter crisis. Never seen anything like this in recent times. Carolina Barrero, a Cuban activist, went on even further. Quote, this is the most massive popular demonstration to protest the government that we've ever experienced in Cuba since 1959. It is spontaneous, frontal, and forceful. She said, what is happening is enormous. These people are crying for liberty. They've had enough. And I'll resist the commentary or the idea of relating it to what's going on in our country. Other than when people have taken freedoms taken away, or they may never had it before, they just taste it. There comes a time when enough gather together and the sentiment grows in numbers, people realize, hey, the government is a few when we're the many. Right? That's, if you want to read the Declaration of Independence and how many of yesteryear had an idea of such things, that when the government no longer represents the will of the people have a right to, let's just say, take to the streets. And I'm loosely paraphrasing the very Declaration of Independence. Speaking of taking to the streets, last summer, we saw all across our country protests. The mainstream called them peaceful protests. A group of police officers have filed a lawsuit in Palo Alto, California, for letting a Black Lives Matter mural remain in place for months after it was painted on a city street last summer in June. City officials permitted and encouraged artists to create 16 different murals on city property that were placed together and spelled out Black Lives Matter. The officer said this in a 12-page lawsuit filed in a California Superior Court. The mural contained in the letter E showed Joanne Chesimard, a.k.a. Asada Shakur, who was convicted in 1977 for murdering a state trooper in New Jersey, but escaped from prison and fled to the United States. Chesimard is a wanted fugitive who is regarded highly by some activists, we'll just say. The officers say they were forced to pass by the mural every time they reported to work, which amounted to, quote, a discriminatory and harassing work environment. This according to the lawsuit. It also went on to say not only did the defendants allow the harassing and discriminatory iconography to exist in the workplace, they also sanctioned, approved, encouraged, and paid for it. Officers raised concerns about the messaging in the mural to city and police officials, but were told that the mural would remain in place. That was a violation, they say, of the Fair Employment and Housing Act. This is according to the lawsuit. For law enforcement required to enter a building, is there any description other than a hostile work environment? Said the National Police Association, calling on people to sign a petition asking for the mural's removal. In a statement last year to news outlets, a city spokeswoman said the contrary, that the mural, quote, is one aspect of a larger city dialogue taking place on race and equity and connects to the city's thoughtful conversations on the role of policing. She also went on to say the mural is temporary and the city has no plans to expedite the removal of the mural sooner than currently planned. Any thoughts? 888-528-2557. Last week, I reported to you that the Utah chapter of the Black Lives Matter movement had some pretty disparaging things to say about the American flag. They said it was a symbol of hatred. Victor Davis Hanson is a historian, and I always am interested in his commentary on issues in the news. And he shared his thoughts on the BLM chapter in Utah, talking about the American flag being nothing but a symbol of hatred.
Well, and they never give us data. You know, it's all vague, racist this and racist that. So we have metrics to adjudicate racism. A minority that makes up a little more than 12% does not elect a president of the United States who's black. A racist society would not allow that. They would not allow Kamala Harris to be vice president. You wouldn't have a race in North Carolina where both the Republican and the Democratic candidate are black. They would have disproportionate, when you have interracial crime that is fairly rare, it would be disproportionately white versus black. That's not true. It's vice versa. If you had anti-Asian hate crimes, it would be white people doing that, not black people in a racist society. And then they don't give us alternatives. We need details. We want to adopt the Chinese model, the Russian model, the German model, the Cuban model, the Venezuelan. What model is superior to this? And then there's a class element. This is not the generation that came out of the civil rights movement, Tucker. Ralph Abernathy, Bernard Rustin, Martin Luther King, that were assimilationists, integrationists, content of our character. They were actually felt and experienced terrible racism, and they came out of impoverished circumstances. But my gosh, We're listening to some of the most privileged people in the United States, LeBron James, Meghan Markle, Oprah Winfrey, and then we have Mr. Kendi or Cornel West or Ta-Nehisi Coates. They all grew up in upper middle class families. They were the epitome of the American dream. They had equal opportunity. They were very successful. It's a very different phenomenon. This is sort of like the French revolutionaries who were upper middle class. Or right. Lenin, or the Marxist, who were upper middle class, or the founder of BLM, Patrice Cuellar, who owns four homes. So I don't think you should really take it, the idea that they're being exploited and suffering in a racist country very carefully. And you know, we this is very dangerous, because historically we're not the norm. We're a aberration. This is a multiracial democracy, and they usually don't work because the natural propensity is to identify by your tribe and superficial appearance. And boy, when you look at the world around us, whether it's Rwanda or Iraq or the former Yugoslavia or the problems they're having in a multiracial democratic Brazil or even India, we do pretty well. And I think these people are historically uninformed, because what they're doing is taking us on a trajectory where we know the end and where it ends up, and it's not pretty, especially if you turn one tribe against the other and you have a war of everybody against everybody. It doesn't work.
Historian Victor Davis Hanson talking about his concern about the promotion of the race dialogue in our country and who is speaking the loudest, people in positions of privilege. Now, I really prayed about opening this can up, but I want to share it with you, and if you have any comments, obviously phone lines are open. For 1 minute, he addressed the ongoing pleadings of Michelle Obama and how she senses she's in danger and how racism has never been more of a problem in our country. And you know where she shares this from.
What does she do? She ventures out of her $14 million Martha Vineyard estate on vacation from her $12 million Washington, D.C. estate, and then she tells us that her daughter's in danger walking out on the street when we have this existential problem of 400 people being killed over the 4th of July, 400 being shot, 150 killed, 100 shot in Chicago, 16 killed, and we were told that if we just had African-American mayors or attorney generals or chief police, and that doesn't seem to help. And so we have existential problems that need to be addressed. And Michelle Obama's blaming society that's endangering her daughters when she knows, and she's wisely knows that she's not going to move back to her Chicago mansion. That would be very unwise given the state of safety in Chicago. And yet nobody talks about these existential problems. And so this race, it's an abstraction among the elite. It's not the concerns of the actual poor and marginalized people in the inner city.
Again, Victor Davis Hanson, your comments are welcomed, 888-528-2557. In our final segment, a man that was elevated as possibly being the next presidential candidate a few years ago by the left is going to prison. Also, a vet is in trouble because of his raising funds for a border wall. And we'll close today with a very popular brother in Christ that we know that has decided to open his own bank. We'll talk about that and much more as we continue next here on the Frank Sontag Show. Welcome back to the Frank Sontag Show. 1 week from today, next Monday, the 19th of July at 3 o'clock, I have a huge announcement that I'd like to share with you on this radio program. You may want to arrange to tune in at 3 next Monday, 3 p.m. Pacific, for a huge announcement. Wasn't that long ago that one man was adulated in the news by the left? Talking heads falling all over themselves, talking about the bravery of this man and how he may even run for president one day. Y'all remember when Michael Avenatti was in the news, interviewed hundreds of times, fawning all over themselves about what an incredibly courageous man this is? Well, last Thursday he was sentenced to 30 months in prison for attempting to extort Nike of up to $25 million. I had audio that I thought of playing, but I think best not to. It's the media on the left, CNN, MSNBC, falling all over themselves back when he's, you're so courageous, oh my gosh, you're such a leader, you're amazing. Yeah, okay. But yet they like to vilify the guy that was in office for 4 years, right? The man that's somehow rewriting history. There's a news report that Donald Trump spoke over the weekend and rewrote the truth of what happened on January 6th. We are being sold a bill of lies. And the mainstream media is on full press right now. And I will just impress upon you, please learn for yourself, research for yourself, think for yourself. Ask God to show you the truth. Because we are being sold a whole bunch of lies, Representative, this is the way to go. And dissension, any other thoughts, squelch, censored, deleted. Now, this next story, I don't know this man personally, but I have my suspicions about what may be the truth here. Brian Colfage is a man that served in this country, paid dearly for it. Now, federal prosecutors have filed new tax and wire fraud charges on him, against him. This is the vet who raised funds online for the construction of a privately funded border wall. Prosecutors charged Colfage with lying on his tax return and causing a wire transfer in connection with the same scheme. Colfage is represented by attorney Kenneth Harmon. The indictments allege that he misrepresented his income on both the original and amended 2019 tax returns. Original return claimed an income of $63,000 plus. The amended return claimed an income of $300,000. The complaint alleges that both amounts were less than what he actually earned. You may remember him. This was before, see, this is the way the media operates. This was before President, then President Trump put all the efforts into building the wall. Colfage decided on himself, hey, let's get together and start building a wall. It's the patriotic thing to do. He started We Build the Wall, Inc. Many say that this is a political hit. And if you know who Brian Colfage is, he has paid the price dearly in defending the country. He is a wounded veteran. I think he's lost both his legs and one arm in service to this country. And he said it's a political hit job. Not knowing all the facts, there's a large part of me that just wonders. Maybe he is indeed telling the truth, and they're just there to punish him for a position he took that literally the left will not tolerate, let alone stand for. It's one thing to not tolerate, but it's another thing to not stand for. Then you pay the price. Then you're attacked. Then you're persecuted. As Nick Vujicic has found out recently, many of us know and love this man who has no limbs, and literally has spoken to millions of Christians around the world about his faith. He is now co-founder of a brand new pro-life bank after he was kicked out of his own. An article alleged a lot of lies when he began to speak for a pro-life cause. Vujicic is president of and CEO of the Ministry of Life Without Limbs. He's been a guest on the program. He's a friend. He shared in a recent interview, quote, I got kicked out of a bank with no warning. It froze my credit cards, froze my debit cards. They did a review of me as a client, and they don't want anything to do with me, end quote. Vujicic learned from the co-founder of his pro-life bank that, quote, most banks give philanthropically under social responsibility to give to causes that provide to the biggest abortion clinics in America. So Vujicic has signed on. The new bank is called Pro-Life Bank. It will be a religious for-profit entity and will not fund abortion. Vujicic said, quote, but we will actually fund 50% net profits to Judeo-Christian line nonprofit organizations that are biblically aligned and doing the will of God according to our belief systems. End quote. Years ago, my algebra teacher, of all people, his name was Jerry Farley. I don't know if he's still with us. One of the best teachers I had in high school. Really, excuse me, I developed a love for math because of him and the way he taught. Many years after graduating, I somehow found him. He was a banker in Toluca Lake. And I called him, took him to lunch, just thanked him for being such a wonderful influence in my young life. And he hadn't changed a bit other than he changed vocations from math teacher to banker. The life of a banker. What do I want to share in closing? If you're not on my mailing list, I say this all the time, you may want to do so. FrankSontag.com is probably the easiest domain to get on my mailing list. I have an announcement a week from today. And also, by the time we meet tomorrow, Lord willing, there will be a huge announcement as it applies to someone that is now throwing their hat in the ring to run for governor of California. Many of you know him. He's making the announcement shortly on his program. And maybe we'll run some audio tomorrow of the big announcement. All I can say is this. Many Californians that have lived in the state generation in and generation out for a long time have about had it with the leadership or lack thereof. We had a caller earlier say, I don't understand. Why would we call the governor? I mean, you just don't understand. We have that right. I think this is only the second time in the history of our state where it's actually gone down. That's got to tell you something in a state that we hear so much about. This is a Democrat-controlled state. Something's amiss. Maybe we're just sick of the hypocrisy. So September the 14th, we will see if we have a recall election. And someone is about to throw their hat in the ring shortly. If I can serve you in any way, if you have any questions, comments, or anything you want to share confidentially, best way to do that, at least right now, is to email me at franksontag@kkla.com. And this is the Frank Sontag Show.